Hello, everyone. This is your host, Manoj Tandon. Welcome to another episode of Dark Rhino Securities, Security Confidential. Today, joining us from a half a world away in the Ukraine is our honored guest, Dmytro Bielitsev. He is the CTO and co-founder of ReSpeecher. Very cool company. I mean, these guys have been doing some very, very cool things. They were the first to be adopted by Hollywood Production Studios in 2019. They have worked on many video games, animation studio projects. Some of the things that you would have heard about would have been Mark Hamill's voice in The Mandalorian. They are the team that was responsible for de-aging it. James Earl Jones' voice as Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know, those are some of their credits and many more. They've been featured in Forbes, The Guardian, TechCrunch, VentureBeat, to name a few. Dmytro, thank you for joining us, and we're really glad you're able to do this all the way from over in the Ukraine.
Yeah, hi, Manoj. Thanks a lot for this amazing intro, and really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I have to ask you, being in the Ukraine, how have you managed to run such a high-tech company in a time of crisis over there?
Right. Yeah. So I guess before the time of crisis, it is still like a really good place for having a high tech company because of, you know, the engineering talent that we have in Ukraine and the kind of the deep tech culture that has been developing in Ukraine since I don't know when. So yeah, it's a pretty good atmosphere and environment for starting a high tech startup like ours. But it is true that it was a super challenging time when the full scale invasion began. You know, started by Russia, and so. I think the sort of the way we managed it is by preparing to this as much as we could. For some things, it's hard to prepare, but in general, like we were aware. We had a guess that probably something's going to happen soon. We're like hugely underestimated, I guess, what happened. But anyway, we prepared a lot. We moved some people around Ukraine just to make sure that in case the internet breaks down or something, we'll still be online and we'll be able to talk to our clients and, you know, stay in touch. Another thing is the company's culture that we have, the culture of like ownership and communication. Okay. Like from the management side, we're upfront with everyone about what's going on. We kind of kept everyone updated about what we're doing as a company, who's going where and who needs help. We're kind of helping as much as possible the team members. And from the team's side, it was like tremendous. It was amazing to see how everyone kind of took ownership of the projects they were working on and kept communicating with the clients, albeit, you know, even in these super challenging times. And I guess the third thing is maybe having an ongoing purpose is kind of helps people distract from really tough things that are happening. And we're helping economy in Ukraine. So that kind of gives us motivation to keep going with this.
Wow. See, you guys have something special. You guys are actually unified in a cause. That's what it sounds like from what you just described.
Right.
And that's not easy to get. You're unified as a company, as a team, as a country. That's there's a lot of power in that.
Yeah, a huge cost, unfortunately, but it's good.
So, you know, you talked a little bit about the company's culture that has helped you sustain. But what's the story behind Respeecher. How did you guys get started? What was the vision? What was this your idea? How did you do it?
Yeah, it wasn't actually that romantic. It was just, so essentially we, there was a hackathon that was organized by Grammarly, which is now okay. like a unicorn Ukrainian startup. So they were holding this, organizing this hackathon on data science, and anyone could come with any idea. So somewhat randomly, we thought that it was going to be cool to try something in audio, because back then the computer vision was, you know, super like more popular than anything else in machine learning. So we kind of dropped in with the idea of like, oh, hey, can we, sounds pretty simple. Can we just take me saying hello and I don't know, Barack Obama saying hello and just, you know, say 1,000 different words and train a network to map these things, you know, maybe it will be able to say something new. So with this naive assumption, we kind of went to this hackathon and it was a lot of fun, took the first place, but the results were very bad. But at that point, we kind of started thinking that, realizing that the potential of the technology, and we also talked to a bunch of studios here in Ukraine, realized that there's a big potential. There's lots of use cases of this technology. And at some point we like didn't do much. It was, you know, just having this as a pet project. But then in 2016-ish, like I guess in the end of 2016, beginning of 2017, Google published this WaveNet paper, which was like a little bit of the puzzle that was missing. You know, like no one could do super high quality speech parametrically, but now they published this little bit and just something clicked and we thought, oh, you know, like it's the right moment. It's gonna, the field's gonna explode. We better start now.
That's amazing. So you guys came out of a hackathon with a little bit of support from Google. Try to explain to a layperson here, how does this technology work?
Essentially, it is in some sense like similar to how sort of like brain works. It just needs to be exposed to a ton of examples of what you want from it. And then it can learn to perform a task and could generalize to new scenarios. So, you know, like computers can simulate physics, right? You can use a computer to make, you know, realistic water movement or something. And in a similar fashion, you can use computer to simulate how neurons learn. In that sense, we use these artificial neural networks that are simulated by a computer. We expose them to thousands of examples of real speech by different people. And then computers try to figure out what it is that, you know, unites all these people. So there's like a ton of different people. They make different sounds, but there's something similar about all of it, because all of this is speech. All of this is comprised of small building blocks, that phonetic units. And then this is something that neural networks get kind of deduce from being exposed to thousands of hours of audio. And that's how our system works. So we show it a ton of audio, and then by looking at it, it kind of learns that, oh, maybe me and Barack Obama have a lot in common. It's just the timbres are different or something. And then I can pronounce a new thing once it's trained, and then it will kind of try to make it sound as Barack Obama.
That's incredible. And have you like overlaid the generated speech pattern over the real person's speech pattern and seen it on a spectrum analyzer? Do they overlay really well? I mean, can you spot it? That, okay, this one is the fake. This is the real.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. It really depends. I mean, if you just take a rendered, like a, right out of the furnace, if you just take it like a raw rendered sample from a synthetic network, in most cases, it will be possible to, it is still possible to identify it using some, you know, clues, some like small nuances, but like by just looking at it, at a spectrogram, I don't think it will be pretty hard to tell which one is true and which one is synthetic, unless you have like, unless you've been trained to tell them apart. And by listening as well, it's pretty hard these days. And the moment you add a little bit of like reverb or like background noise or some sort of like realistic sound effects, then it becomes really hard, even like both for humans and for deep fake detection algorithms.
So how did, I mean, it's pretty obvious that Hollywood would be very interested in something like this, but how did they find you guys?
Oh, I guess it's a funny story. So, I mean, of course we, from the very beginning of the company, our main initial goal was to, hey, I mean, synthetic speech is fun, but can we make it, you know, as good and as high quality that it will actually at some point in time see it on a big screen? That was kind of our dream. And so we did put a lot of effort into reach out and things. But what actually got us our first kind of really cool Hollywood contract was just one of our, like a super indirect thing, like one of our advisors told about to his friend about our technology, and then the friend worked at a sound effects or the visual effects studio, and then they kind of just, you know, sent it out on an internal chat for technical people, and then someone picked it up, and then it just so happened that people at Lucasfilm were kind of really needed the tech, and they kind of reached out, so we started talking, and we got our first project out.
Well, let me ask you this: like when for Mark Hamill's voice, or for Obi-Wan Kenobi's voice with James Earl Jones, how much effort do you have to put into it to create that voice? Does it involve the actual actors coming into a studio and saying a bunch of phrases, or how does this all work? How does the process work then?
Right. So for like, we do a lot of, we call these studio projects. It means that we have, like, part of it is a service. We have a delivery team that has synthetic speech artists or people who have like a lot of experience in professional sound engineering, sound design, but they're also technical. They can train models and, you know, evaluate them and do things like this. So within these, for these studio projects, and we've delivered more than 100 of them over the years. So these studio projects, the pattern is like this. Initially, a client sends us a sample, whatever they have in terms of data for the target character. And then the people look at this. People in the delivery team look at the target data and see if it's suitable for training. Like if there's, because it could be like really bad historical recordings that are corrupt and we can't use them. So sometimes we refuse. But assuming it works, the delivery team kind of just takes that and starts training the network, essentially. And once the network, it takes a week or two, depending on how urgent the project is and how good the data is, to train the network. And then once the network is trained, we send back drafts, what we call drafts, like initial conversions, to whoever is responsible for this stream at the studio. So they look at it and they maybe use it in their draft mixes. They show it to the director, and the director says, "Oh, I see. Let's change this line, or maybe let's add some more emotion there." And then they go back to the studio. An actor records a bunch of new lines, gets sent to us, gets converted to the target character, and then these iterations go on for some time, depending on the projects. For urgent projects, it could take maybe a week or something. But for big projects, some of the ones that we did for Lucasfilm, it could take months.
And at the end of the project, then do you deliver the studio then an entire model? So then they don't even need that actor's voice anymore. They can just all future episodes, they can just generate the voices or.
Oh no, no. Yeah. So our deliverable is rendered audio files, you know, much like a VFX studio would, their deliverable is a rendered part of a particular project with a particular character or a particular scene. So in the same way, we generate a bunch of lines that are required for a certain project that we're working on. And that's our deliverable. We never give our models out, and we never own anyone's identity, because we believe that the owner of the voice must own their identity, and the permissions they give for studio projects are usually per project.
You know, and that's a very noble thing to do. You know, we look at in the world of cybersecurity, what you guys have built has huge potential for disruption, right? I mean, if we were to play the dark side of this out, when we look at people trying to influence an election, and let's just pick on that one, because in the U.S. that's a paranoid topic that's been going on for the last 4 years or so, and God knows how much longer it's going to go on. But, you know, there was all the fakes on Facebook that were attributed to China. There were, or most of them were, not all of them, of course. There's been all kinds of social media peddling out there. But now with what you have and what's available visually, the marriage of the two, you could create a high-profile political figure that's totally fake and have them put out a social media message, and there'll be a chunk of the population that will absolutely believe it, whether you tell them it's a lie or not, right?
Yeah.
And that's a real danger.
Yeah. So that is true. I mean, misinformation is a huge danger, has been a real danger in general. Like think about all the articles that are written by Russian media, for example, and a huge pop, even in Ukraine, like a big portion of the population just reads the article, they believe it. And it is a problem. With regards to specifically media, I think what we've been doing with this content authenticity initiative by Adobe or with XC2PA is a strong step forward towards sort of combating potential misuse of deepfakes. And our tech can't really be used for this because we require permission. We keep our tech to ourselves. But of course, there's other tech that out there. This part of it, some of it is open source, and it could be misused. But what Provenance is trying to do is, instead of trying to make algorithms that detect deepfakes, which is, as I mentioned before, getting like harder and harder. Instead of that, they kind of flip the problem upside down, and they say, "Hey, let's introduce content credentials, which is a cryptographic way of cryptographically signing a piece of media content. And if someone modifies it, then it will be possible to see that modification. You're not going to be able to verify the certificate." So the idea is, of course, it's reliant on adoption, but the idea is for all the big media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, like YouTube, whatever, to adopt this technology and flag content that doesn't have content credentials as potentially dangerous. Or something like this, in the same sense as we have with HTTPS. Right now, if you go to an HTTP web page, even if it's harmless, you'll still, like, most browsers will prevent you from seeing it and, like, warn you that, hey, this is potentially dangerous because it's not encrypted. So in the same sense, if you submit a fake video of a politician saying something to YouTube, and you want to conceal your identity, and you're not going to sign it with anything, then the YouTube will notify users that, hey, this is potentially fake. Because all the good players are kind of interested in say, like, signing their media with their credentials. And Respeecher's marketplace, for example, signs all the outgoing audio with our content credentials.
And that, I guess, for major media, that makes a lot of sense, and it's a great step in the right direction. But what about the cases where we use someone uses a similar technology to, you know, in cybersecurity, there's been an ongoing, if the target is rich enough, you know, if there's enough value in this target, whoever you're going after, then to compromise their identity, you know, use a technology like yours to create their voice, and then you can call their bank, you can call, or you call their company and say, hey, this is Manoj. I need you to wire $500,000 to Dimitro right now. And the person on the other side, I know Manoj. This sounds like him. It's the right voice. Oh, what's your date of, you know, all the sure. stupid, easy questions that everybody can hack and get access to, you know, how old you are, what's your social security number, your address, all the easy things.
Right.
The other end of the line, that's better than hacking, because now I can get someone to send money out without having to do anything. They'll do all the hard work for me.
Yeah, definitely. So this is called vishing. I didn't know that.
I learned a new word today.
Yeah, it's like voice phishing.
Voice phishing.
Yeah, and like voice cloning is there has been several cases now which do exactly what you just described. And again, it's kind of it is an issue, and but the good thing is that it follows like a similar pattern to phishing. And you could use similar tools to fight against it. Like, for instance, we're talking to a bunch of security consulting firms, and in particular, we had like a joint blog post by Richie May about this. And the idea is to use voice cloning together with security consulting firms to perform social engineering attacks on companies to try to expose whether employees are susceptible to these kinds of attacks, and then remediate by introducing appropriate training and appropriate like internal processes in the company that would make sure that people are aware of this. Because, I mean, I think it's going to be pretty hard to fool me with vishing, for example, because I'm aware about these things. In a similar sense, a well-trained personnel in a firm and a bunch of well-established processes would kind of most probably help with most of these attacks.
Now, you've done so many really cool studio projects. Is there one that was a favorite of yours personally?
If I had to pick one, probably the Luke Skywalker's voice for Boba Fett. And maybe it was, I guess it was mostly a personal thing because it was a lot of material, like just not a single or two lines. It was like a bunch of, it was like almost, you know, a big portion of an episode. And it was really sort of the highest quality that we could do by that time. And it was like, they didn't apply, you know, a huge amount of posts because the quality was pretty good. And then there was no, you know, much there wasn't much music. The speech was like really kind of out there, really exposed and sort of intricate. And it was kind of a cool moment for me to realize, oh, hey, like here we are. Here's the synthetic speech on a big screen. It sounds great. It sounds natural. And this is something I was like really, frankly, like skeptical about when we started the company. I was like, I guess we should take a shot, but it's pretty like unlikely that it's going to be, you know, that good. So it was, yeah, it was kind of a nice personal moment for me.
Now in that one, you actually de-aged Mark Hamill's voice, right?
Yeah, we brought back his young voice using by training the network on his young recordings.
Dimitro, I bet you there's a university out there that has researched voice aging, and they probably have graphs and charts and tons of data that shows how the timbre, pitch, everything changes with age. You might be able to build a forecasting model. There's somebody out there. You go looking hard enough, it's surprising what you find.
Maybe you're right. We'll see.
So you guys also have done work with animal voices. Have you have you tried playing them in like in a real animal environment and seeing if the real animals actually buy it? Do they?
No, we tried it with dogs. We even had like a small video about it, but unfortunately, because the driver is still a human, so in order to make barking, you need to kind of bark yourself. It's going to make it sound like a real dog's bark. It's not going to sound like a human trying to bark. But you still, I guess, in order to imitate animal language, you need to bark the right way with right intervals. So unfortunately, we didn't have a professional barker on the team.
That would be a tough resume. I mean, go look for that on, you know. That's right. In the world of, in field biology, you know, if you want to pull in some strange kind of critter and you can mimic the actual critter that you want to attract, well...
Oh, like we're for hunters. I don't know.
You know, like I mean, well, that's big sounds. In North America. Right now, you're sitting there, you know, with a little gadget in your mouth or whatever, you know, and trying to mimic a duck or a moose or whatever it is that you're trying to do. But be a lot easier if you just play it on your iPhone or your Android and say, here.
Yeah, it'll be a vishing attack against the moose.
Vishing attack against animals. So what's next for you? You've done this. This is really cool work. What are your plans for ReSpeech? What are you guys planning on doing here in the future?
Totally. What we're up to is we do want to keep going with our studio directions because it's it's a lot of fun to make, and also like, we take pride in making these voices for cool pictures out there, and to, you know, participating in movies, in creating nice movies and films. So we'll keep doing that, but we're also exploring the ways of democratize the technology for that we use in studios for like wider audience and smaller content creators that might want to scale voices or they might need more diversity in their small game or movie. We've built this, we've released this B2C platform called Marketplace.
Okay.
So we're kind of actively developing that and adding new features, adding more voices to the library. And that, on that platform, you can speak with one of the voices, with several voices from our library and have multiple voice over multiple characters in your game. So we're going to keep working on that. But what's also cool is the real-time voice conversion where we can speak with different voices in real-time on Google Meets or something like that. And also in call centers, you might an agent might pick a voice that is the most, you know, suitable for the client they're serving. And also, what's really cool about it is that it could also be used for medical purposes. Like, for example, we're working with this with a medical device company that makes these electrolaryngs, and electrolaryngs is this device that laryngectomy patients are using. And those are people who had throat cancer, yep. and they had yep. their vocal cords removed. So they need some source of pitch. And so what they do is they use electrolaryngs. It's like a vibrating device that you put to your to where your vocal cords were, and then it kind of generates the vibrating sound, and a person could speak. But then the speech is sounds, you know, somewhat robotic. And what you could do with real-time voice conversion is you can try to turn that robotic speech into natural speech that sounds similar to what they sounded like before they underwent the surgery. And yes, so this is something that really inspires us to keep working on the real time.
Fantastic. Well, Dimitro, it's been an honor to talk to you, and we're honored. And, you know, as things progress, don't be a stranger. Feel free to reach out if you would ever like to come back and keep us abreast. It's a fascinating technology, and congratulations on all the great work and your success.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Then take care and have a
awesome.
Good evening.
Thanks, Manoj.